Welcome to Development as a Service, a show for freelancers, contractors, and employees making a living as developers.
We're here to share some stories, tools, and ideas that are helping us navigate the twists and turns of working in the service industry.
We're your hosts. I'm Carter Bryden.
And I'm James Doyle.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about what is development as a service, the idea of it, not the podcast, and why would you want to be involved with it, why do we like it, all those good things.
Yeah, I think the first thing to lay out is, like, what is a service? What are we talking about when we mean development? Mm-hmm. So there's, like, a couple different categories, I guess you could say, of development, whether that's you're working on, maybe we should just list some of them then. Some of these potentials. There's going to be more, or there's going to be more narrow versions. But I think we have four broad categories that would cover it. So the first one would be product development, which I think should be pretty straightforward. Service development, so a client vendor sort of relationship. Open source development, whether that's for a community or in some sort of, commercial capacity. And then finally, it would be some sort of like home project or self project or group project maybe, or
could be if you're
like
in
that.
School maybe, or doing a boot camp or something.
In which case the service is like, who's the service for in all of these different cases? And that's kind of the concept of or for you and I particularly, like our sort of professional lives have been like selling our skill of development as a service that someone buys, whether that's as a business owner or like a contractor or some kind, freelancer or an employee, being like, I'm buying the development service of this employee. At least that's the thing that I'm selling personally these days. I don't know if you would necessarily agree with that or not.
Yeah, I would say anything that you're not selling the product itself necessarily. I guess you could say that the end result of your work is the product, but I think most people would agree when they're talking about their work, either they are working on a product or they're working on someone else's product or someone else's software. And so either as an employee, a freelancer, an agency owner, for instance, any of those things, I would qualify those as development as a service rather than product development. Or I would also separate open source out of there, even though you're not necessarily the owner,
right?
Or the entire owner,
right?
Or something like that. That comes with such a different context that I wouldn't qualify.
How many people are whole cloth creating like something in open source that doesn't have some derivative work inside of it that is open source?
Yeah.
Like these days, I mean, at least for the, in particular with web, I think is a little bit more high level, especially with like so much scripting going on, like scripting languages going on, is that you're usually like whipping together some libraries, some low level libraries, or joining a bunch of modules or joining a bunch of libraries and then releasing that as like, hey, this is my open source like thing.
There's some gluing together going
on. Glue is a service.
Glue is a service.
I think also it's great because it's a play on platform as a service and software as a service, so that's kind of fun too.
Yeah, everything is as a service these days. So it does, it keeps in with the whole culture of that. So I guess since we're doing a show about development as a service, we should probably talk about what's good about it. Why do we like it? What do we care about? Why should other people care about this?
Yeah, I think the best thing for me probably is that the variety of work is important, but the skill set is sort of, I'm still building that skill set. So the skill set that I have is about like, okay, that's the development part. The service part is always changing. What's the service that I'm being contracted by? Whether that's an employee, a contractor, my own business at one point. What is that? What is on top of that development? What's the service layer? What does that look like? And it changes constantly. Maybe it hasn't changed for someone in 5 years, but for someone it could change on a monthly basis. But at the end of the day, it's the development side that's being delivered as the service that they're asking for.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. The variety there, and the fact that depending on what you do, you know, if you if you are an employee, that might be a little less, or it might be a little bit more restricted, sorry, for things that you have to do. So you might not necessarily have to deal with the client itself. That might be a project manager, those kind of things. But in general, you're going to be doing more. You're going to have a wider variety of skills. You may be a little bit shallower in some, but I find that the whole T-shaped developer is a very common in people who do development as a service.
Maybe you can mention what T-shaped is, because that's a very...
Yeah, for sure. So
it's not that obvious.
T-shaped would be would mean that you are deeply skilled in one or a limited number of things, and you are somewhat skilled in a much wider array of things. So, for instance, as a developer, you might know how to deploy your software to a server. You might know a little bit of design, for instance, maybe. But your main skill set might be developing PHP applications, or it might be just the back end.
So in which case that you might have a width of skills or a breadth of skills, but the depths of those skills change dramatically. So the breadth is the horizontal axis, and the depth, or the like the I guess the expertise, I guess you could even use that like just to use like a broad term, would be either very, very deep, as in it's much, much longer, much, much stronger emphasis as far as what the actual, like, a literal T kind of means. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of tough because I think, I guess it really depends. I don't know if I've always thought about, like, product development as being something where you get a lot of depth, where you get a lot of, you narrow your expertise, so your breadth of experience shrinks, but your depth of experience grows. So you have less items to work on, but you become an expert in those items quicker, or you become more skilled in those items because you're narrowing your field of, like, I guess, quote unquote research. And then something where it's like, I find the agency life, you have so many different problems. Every project is like a greenfield project for the majority of times. So your breadth of skills changes, but your depth sometimes suffers a little bit because of that.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I would also kind of say that when you're working in service, actually someone once told me, when you're creating something new, which let's say that's the product side of things, you're sort of telling the world how something needs to be. You're influencing the world. Whereas when you're fixing something or you're working on someone else's thing, you have to listen to what the world is telling you. You have to listen to the way that it is. And so I think in service, you get a little bit more of a balance there. When you're working on products, you're trying to forge something new, forge ahead in something that might be completely new. When you're working in service, you need to be able to listen to the clients maybe, or the scope, the requirements, the timeline, a lot of things that you really have to factor in, and you have to listen to them. You can't just say how things are going to be, or you're not being useful.
This is kind of an aside, but somewhat related, but at work the other day, I was talking to the group of our developers, and we were talking about like how we can sort of use client projects to also research like new tools, like, oh, maybe we want to use a queue, or like maybe we want to use like one of these like more sophisticated, like a time series database, or just some wonky thing that we want to try, and like making sure that it fits, but also making sure that we can justify the reason that we did something that was, you know, somewhat experimental. And that it reminded me of that quote, the Henry Ford quote, where if I asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse.
Exactly. Yeah.
So like knowing when to take control, and whether to, I guess, I don't know, it's not even concede control, but like
when to listen.
Yeah, when to listen is hard, but it's also about like, okay, well, that affects your work in a really like fundamental way. Are you listening and just giving someone what they're asking for, or are you looking for some sort of outcome and then deciding how to get there?
Yeah.
And I don't think it's necessarily that one product, the one a product or two a service depicts either case. I think it's just it's on a case by case basis. It's not like one means more, I don't think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I tend to find that, at least in service, you want to be the expert, typically. So the reason that someone is seeking you out for your service, whether it's an employer or a client, is because you are the expert and they need your expertise. So there is a certain amount of leading and saying no and changing minds about things when your expertise and knowledge sort of outweighs maybe their opinion or their previous concepts.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean that you should not listen to them.
Right.
Because often they are the domain expert. They are right, and your previous concepts should be outweighed by their expertise. But in general, I think it's much more of a balance and finding the right level of that. I would say that in products, though, it's a little bit more telling the world or putting things out there than it is listening.
With the product?
Yeah, I think so. If you're in product development, or at least anyone who's really successful in product development, they tend to be listening a little bit less.
I think of Apple when you describe that type of product.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, hey, we're taking away your headphone jack.
Yeah.
Because you don't need it. And then everyone's like, what?
Yeah.
How dare you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, there's always a balance there to some degree. I think that it's just a little bit more weighted to telling than listening in products. Because if you're going to do something new and better...
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what it is. It's new and better, and so you can't listen for the old opinions and things.
I think Google might be somewhat of an opposite in terms of someone like Apple, where because of their data, they can be like, I think this is probably how a lot of things like Google Maps and stuff came about. It's like, people want directions. People keep looking for directions. We should just give them directions.
Yep.
Or like, people keep typing in calculations into the field. We should just show them what the answer to the calculation is. Or if someone just asks a question, we should just give them the answer right away instead of like having them search through results to find the answer. That's just kind of, maybe not every product, obviously, with Google, but Google, the site, the search engine, I think, is probably somewhat of a definitely listening a lot more than telling, I would think.
I would agree with that. I would also say that a lot of Google's most successful and most popular things are on the edge of something that is a product or a service.
Right.
Some of their things are called services when you use them, at least as a developer.
Yeah, Google Apps.
Yeah. And so that could be part of it. I think, once again here, there's no one size fits all, but when I think of product development, I think of a little bit less listening. So I guess back to development as a service here more. One other thing that I really think that sort of lends itself to why you would want to do this is there's more direct and obvious paths to success in development as a service than there are as products. It's really, really hard to come up with the next great, amazing product.
Yeah.
There are always people out there that need your help in development, whether they have the next great idea for a product, whether they need something fixed, improved. There's just always more work out there. And so it's definitely more obvious where to go.
I think I see the opposite attitude reflected sometimes in like hackathons. Where it's like, come up with an idea and build it. But it's like, those two skills can sometimes be very segmented. Like, just because you can do the work doesn't mean you can also come up with the ideas. Yeah. I think that people, their view is skewed with success stories of like, this guy's an innovator or this girl's an innovator. She knows how to do this. And like, she can also build it. It's like, oh, cool. Like, this person comes up with the idea and executes on it. But like, that's not the majority of people. at least in my experience, especially with like going to a bunch of these hackathons and seeing like struggling to come up with the idea is like 50% of the problem.
Yeah.
Or maybe more, because like you give an impressive, you know, you made an impressive API, but like for blog posts, it's like, well, mm-hmm. that's kind of, you know, what's the value of
like
that?
Communicating the idea or turning it from something that's a vague concept into something concrete enough that you can start building it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like those are all completely different skills. And I agree. A lot of the time they're very split up between people. Like sometimes the person with the best ideas is not the person that can build it.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say that's a pretty rare case. Even, you know, Steve Jobs, since we were talking about Apple,
yeah.
I don't think that guy was that great of a coder compared to all the developers that worked for him.
Yeah, but well, Steve Wozniak, too.
He had Steve Wozniak, yeah.
Do that kind of stuff for him.
Yeah, exactly. But he was often, at the very least, he was a good aggregator of good ideas,
mm-hmm.
you know, and people can argue about
or he had, like,
how far that went. But
his judgment was not necessarily right, but it was... it brought economic prosperity to his company.
Yes. Yeah. He had a talent for letting the best ideas get to production at the very least, whatever that means and how, you know, how that actually happened. I don't know, but, definitely one of the things.
Well, for me personally, like I recently made a change from like running a business to working for a business. And it wasn't like I went to another business to work on sales or like client management. Like I left a company that I started to focus more on development.
Mm-hmm.
But my personal opinion was that I was more valuable as a developer than I was as like a business owner.
Yeah.
Which I think is true because I'm doing better now than I was when I was running my own business, like fiscally at least.
Probably happier too.
Yeah. I'm doing more of what I want.
Yeah.
So in which case like, okay, well, the economy is telling me, or my opportunities are telling me, the opportunities I'm being propositioned with are telling me what I should be focusing on, which I think a lot of people like lose perspective on because they think they're trying to solicit an opportunity versus like taking advantage of ones that are coming their direction.
Yeah.
I think with something like, hey, people want to buy development, a lot of people, and they just can't stop. Everything in, like, can you even go through today without touching a piece of like code in some way? Like, I'm even thinking about, I think about the elevator. Like, can you think about programming an elevator with two shafts? So someone at the bottom presses a button as it's going down, it needs to stop with the other things that are pressed. Mm-hmm. But if it's certain elevators might go past your floor to pick up someone on a lower floor before it goes back up to the top. So just thinking about how an elevator sort of operates is like, I can't even leave my building without, I can't even like leave my building. I can turn on my lights. That's electricity. I think it's still, it's still analog at least.
Yeah.
But, I don't think the elevator is, it's got to have a computer in it.
Oh yeah, so, for sure. That brings me back to my school days. We had to write an elevator system in one of my classes.
How was it? Was it hard?
It was more complicated than I thought it would be. It was a pretty good, I think it was a second year project. Touched on a lot of things, but there's a lot more to think about than you think there are with elevators.
Then go to
then,
the floor.
Then up and down. I agree. You're definitely touching technology everywhere, and nothing is expanding and growing like technology. I don't like using the phrase technology because it's such an insanely wide,
right?
You know, word there. Just software development itself is—it's basically growing into every other industry. Like it's now got its fingers in everything I can think of.
Yeah,
I can't think of a single industry that has no software in it at all.
Yeah, even like.
Short of Amish, fireplace building or something like that.
Even
I don't know
if you want to say like even I was thinking of like a carpenter, but like how are the tools designed?
Mm-hmm.
These days they're designed in like a CAD. Like if you wanted to buy like a chisel, like the chisel is probably designed in CAD, it's printed, you know, it might be printed or it might be stamped out of sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's the tool didn't get to the shelf by like a bunch of individuals like hammering and you know, forging. Mm-hmm. It's not the 1800s.
Oh,
it's,
even things like laser levels and stuff.
Oh, for
you
sure.
Know, like, you go to any construction site, I guarantee you, you're going to see a bunch of computer-driven things. They might seem simple, but they're there for sure.
I was at Whole Foods yesterday, and they were the way they measure the temperature of the food mm-hmm. is they use a laser temp gun. So they just point it at the hot pan or whatever, and they just tell you, oh, it's the optimal temperature. Yeah. They turn it up or down. But like there's not an analog thermometer like poking into a chicken breast.
No,
it's just like they point it at the bottom of the pan. They're like, yeah, it's.
Yeah,
whatever
exactly.
Degrees.
Well, and anything that you can think of where you're going, oh, I don't think there's that much software in it right now. I guarantee you, guaranteed, there are several hundred people out there right now that are trying desperately to break into that industry with software. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
Is it groceries? Like, oh, there's tons of people who are trying to improve your grocery buying with a bunch of software.
Yeah.
You're a carpenter? I guarantee it.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, they're everywhere. So definitely, it's not going away anytime soon. The number of programmers is certainly going up, but not even close to the growth of the industry itself.
Well, even now, there's all these what would you call them? Sort of subcultures of popping up, or like sub-services around development, like training.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we can walk from where we're recording this. We can walk, you know, a few kilometers in any direction and run across one of these like code schools, you know, as they're kind of like colloquially known, but it's like basically accelerated training programs so that people can learn how to code.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's like HTML and CSS and JavaScript or like something more sophisticated, like you're learning like Node or Ruby or any mm-hmm. backend language or Objective-C mobile development, like they narrow down. But even the subservices on top of that is like, even a badly like, developers definitely know this, badly designed stuff. I mean, aesthetically, is still not attractive, even if it's a cool tool. The best tools that I've used are like the ones that are both aesthetically and functionally impressive. So even the subservices are like adjacent services that you might have when you get when you're buying development would be something like design. It's like that's still going crazy too. People are desperate for designers. People need like interface designers, user experience designers, people that can like measure analytics, like know what to change. There's all mm-hmm. these other things that are popping up around QA. Like now everything's a program. So who's going to QA all this stuff?
Yeah.
Like you can write unit tests until you're blue in the face, but like how do you plan for someone who's like seeing impaired and wants to use your program? Like, okay, well, didn't think about that. How do we test for that?
Yep.
So it's all this crazy stuff that like pops up around it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really obvious what the next step is as far as like, well, we could talk in a year and there might be a different type of service. There could be 3D as a service or VR as a service. Mm-hmm. Like all these crazy things just pop up and they become commercialized.
Well, think about the new iPhone AR stuff.
Yeah.
Like in some ways, that's a service for developers to use now. You know, oh, now you can make apps using that. That's
or even
a whole
Siri.
Yeah, or Siri or, yeah. or any of those things. Those are whole new industries, I guess. I mean, I want to call them a sub industry or a sector or something within an industry, but really, like, there are people who that's all they do,
mm-hmm.
and entire companies, all those kind of things. So anyways, I guess the gist of this is that this stuff isn't going away. It's definitely growing, and there's going to be a lot more work in the future. So it's definitely something to consider. And then as a result of all this work and all this wide variety of people and potential work, your skill set that you're going to be using for this is going to be tested and improved on a consistent basis.
Yeah.
So every time you get a new project that even if you're a niche freelancer or a niche agency, let's say, and all you do is one specific set of projects.
Yeah.
The variety that each different client brings in means that you're going to be updating your skill set constantly, keeping it strong, learning new things, you're going to have to try new technologies, new methodologies and things just to prevent yourself from going out of date, which, sure, that could be stressful at times, but for the most part, it's actually pretty enjoyable to get to try new things on right. someone else's dime.
Really. Definitely.
You know, as long as you can provide the outcome that they're looking for, you can test new things in there.
Right.
You know,
I've been working on a new a presentation about some delivering complicated development projects, and one of the sort of phrases that I've been trying to squeeze in, it's something I need to finesse it, but it's something like, if someone told you they could make you smile, would you care how?
Right.
So it's kind of like this idea of, this is my own personal sort of like, I'm hammering this out still, the, how I want to phrase it, but it's something like that, where I'm thinking about how to talk to our clients about, hey, so like, you want this thing to happen. Like, do you want to tell me how it should work, or do you want me to find out like mm-hmm. the best path? It's like, we can do both. One is quick and one is slow. One is an experiment. One is, you know, it's basically, you know, service to be vague about it. But it's tough to say sort of like where that line is and like where to cross it. But I was thinking about what you were saying about the methodology thing is like, the challenges don't always have to be necessarily around like, what are you doing? What are you changing about your development? But it could be like what you said with the methodology is like, okay, well, your budget just got slashed by 20%. How are you still going to deliver?
Mm-hmm. Are you still doing TDD, or are you cutting that out and just getting it done this week?
I mean, thinking like, yeah. I know that you have a project template for some projects that come up that are more templated. You might have something like a little starter. And I have one too. I have one for doing like front end development where it's like, hey, I have this thing that I'm really, really familiar with. It helps me get started on a project. Like, it puts me way ahead. I've spent probably a solid week in total, like time, like 40 hours of a week over, you know, years improving this thing, you know, just thousands of commits on this one little starter template, making it a little bit better every time, improving it a little bit more. And so I become so familiar with it that whenever I pick it up and use it, I can like fly through a lot of work.
Yeah.
But like that has nothing to do with me as a developer necessarily. Like, I'm not learning a new algorithm or like learning a new framework. I'm just like getting more familiar with tools and improving my own tool set and sort of like coming to the site with your own, coming to the construction site with your own hammer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of like, yeah, out of my way. I can get this done. Yeah. Like, let me just use my hammer and I'll get this done.
Yep. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, everybody needs to make use of the tools and the things that they've built up that help them get their job done on time and budget, all of those things. But I definitely find that when you're doing service work, you are going to have to expand that as time goes on, which is, again, for some people, that might be a scary concept. I know for myself, I like the fact that I'm exposed to these things, that sometimes I get to work with things that otherwise I might not if I was, say, working on a product and specializing in a specific area of that product. And it definitely keeps you sharp, and it's sort of like throwing someone out into the water and saying, swim a little bit, in that you just have to, you know? And so there's definitely a certain competency that I find shows up in people who've done a lot of service work. Now, there's a flip side to that sometimes. Some people will do exactly enough to get the outcome without necessarily thinking ahead or what is in the best interest of the client long term, things like that. That is another result, and that's something that people have to watch for and avoid and practice discipline. And
well, sometimes basically, people actively solicit that type of work.
Oh, for sure.
Like, hey, I need you to fix this now, like whatever it takes.
Okay. I would say that's almost one of the most common problems
definitely.
In service work is people trying to get you to drop the quality to get something done on a cheaper budget or on a faster timeline. But yeah, definitely something to look out for.
Yeah. I think it's funny because thinking about like greenfield projects and how there's a lot of advantages to that, I think about some of the problems of like these larger products that are like, they're on a completely like different they're on like a different plane of the universe almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I heard this story about Instagram, and like when Instagram was first sort of starting in their first couple of years, I think it was Justin Bieber. Whenever he would post something on Instagram, Instagram would crash because right. he had so many followers and he had so many likes, people liking his mm-hmm. Posts, that it would just like overload the system and it would just kill it.
Yeah.
And like it became so common that the engineers actually memorized his user ID, and it would be like, oh, Twitter's down, or Instagram's down. Oh, is it user 613-7727? It's like, yep. Oh, it's Jay Beebs. He's just crashed the system again. And so their challenge was like, how do we reorchestrate the like concept or the like feature, mm-hmm. so that we can handle, you know, hundreds of thousands of likes in, you know, the span of a couple hours, which is an insane amount of traffic, and also keep the UIs updated and all this other stuff, and make sure that it's all synced and it's actually kind of real time because it has feedback when you press the like button, like the like count goes up or whatever.
Yeah.
And some of these photos can have like hundreds of thousands of likes. Like, how do you manage that? And so they actually had to solve this problem, which was like, well, they can't just like Google on Stack Overflow, like, huge amount of traffic, like button, UI, you know, 100,000 requests per second. So yeah. you can't really, you're on the cutting edge. It's like you're in the PhD of like,
yeah, you're doing the academic research in real time. Yeah,
it's like, yeah. It's kind of crazy. You're literally on the fringe of like this. We are actually the first ones that are actually going to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of leads back to like the open source thing, which is like, is your service around something like just selling open source stuff? Like, how many people make their living on like selling WordPress?
Yeah,
like tons. There's a, you know, arguably 40% of the internet or whatever that ridiculous number is, 40% of websites or some crazy number.
Yeah.
It's like someone got paid to make those, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody built every one of those.
Yeah.
You know, again, going back to how much work there is in this. But yeah, it is sometimes a shocking difference between, product work and service work. I find that as someone who consumes a lot of media and you know, blogs, podcasts, you name it, on development and software development business and all those things, almost everything is geared towards product, building products to product companies, people working on products. There's not a lot out there that is for the person building someone else's thing, you know? And so it's sometimes funny because you could get the sense that, oh, this is the way I should build things. I should build things like Google does,
right?
With their insane greenfield, you know, moonshot products and,
yeah.
And, work that way. And you know, cause it works for them. And that's just not the case in service work a lot of the time. And I think a lot of people look at that and they go, well, of course I want to work in products then. I get these greenfield insane budgets and all these things.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people also, once they get into that, will find that, you know, that everything is not necessarily all rosy there either.
Right.
You tend to get niched into a specialty. You tend to work on the same thing over and over. There's considerations on both sides, I guess.
Right. I think I've thought about them. I think I can generalize it in a quick couple sentences. I think for an agency, your challenge is never having perfection.
Mm-hmm.
That's the burden of the agency, is that you're always working on something that's like half finished.
Yep.
Whether you know, say it's 100%, nothing's ever 100% done, and at least in the world of like websites and stuff, because it's just like constantly changing. But in the world of the product is that the variety is limiting.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of giving up one problem for another.
Yeah.
And like you said, I think on a product, you're probably nailing down a certain skill set, and you're maybe a slave to any previous decisions. Whereas something like an agency is like, you might be there to say like, I want to use this thing that came out yesterday.
Yep.
Like, I want to use this thing that's not even out really yet in like a version one.
Mm-hmm.
That happened to me with Vue.js. I was using Vue before it hit version one, because I was able to, because I could just make any decision that I wanted to regarding what we were going to build the website with.
Yeah,
but like,
and as long as it works.
Yeah, and all it had to do was work for me.
Yeah,
I didn't even have the burden of a team. It was like, hey, do I like this? does James like this one thing?
Yeah.
It's like, yep. Okay, I guess we're using it. We meaning me. So it's like, you just don't really have that when you have, you know, the burden of not only a team, but also a company behind the product. Is like, you can't make sort of whimsical decisions about stable software deciding, hey, let's use this for like our hundreds and thousands of customers.
Yeah. Well, and the thing about like these nice big budgeted greenfield projects is that they become legacy projects pretty quickly.
Sure.
And so, you know, what is a greenfield project a year in? It's a legacy project. You just don't know it yet.
Right. You know, legacy is just very short.
Yeah. And so when you're working in service, every project almost is a greenfield project in many ways. Even if it's something that you're adding something new to an existing site or something like that, it's greenfield to you. You know, it's new. So you're always building something new. You're always doing a new thing, which can be very interesting, very exciting. On the flip side, there can be some burnout there. Sometimes it's hard to do something new all the time. Sometimes you want to make something, you want to take something from good to great, which in service you don't always get to do because all you have is that phase one, maybe a phase two.
Or you have to be more picky about where to apply that energy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of MVPs. MVPs. In service work. Yeah. MVPs. Minimum viable product.
Yeah. So it's funny because it's for the amount of MVPs that I've worked on, like very, very few times have I had to come back and like work on the phase two. Mm-hmm. Not saying that they weren't successful on phase two. I wasn't necessarily solicited to provide the service for phase two.
Sure.
I can think of one in particular I worked on about 2 years ago now. I was working on it with another guy, and he was basically being trained to take the project away from the company once it was finished, which is like, that's exactly what the client was looking for.
Yeah.
Like, build this for us and train someone to also help us improve it. Cool. We can definitely do that. And that's what we did. So it's like, I get to look from far away and think about some of the decisions that were made, or, you know, every day my contributions are fleeting because it's just changing so much, and eventually it'll be 100% different.
And at the time when you're developing them, though, you are a major contributor to this thing typically. The people that you're building it for, they remember, they know what you did. In a lot of ways, I find that service work is very concrete in that the people that I helped are there. They remember me for a long time. They know who I am. The thing that I built, even if it's totally different a year later because some other developers or their own team or whatever, you know, keeps building it, keeps changing it, there's always that thing that I built. Whereas sometimes working on products, you can end up as more of a cog in the machine. And so it's hard to say, oh, well, there's the thing that I built. It's under the hood. You can't really see it. It's part of 500 other developers' work.
I'm wondering how this ecosystem will change, or how the attitude will change for a lot of people, which is like, lately I've been building a lot of things where I'm splitting the API and the front end. Like, client and server are literally separate repos, separate projects. They talk to each other over a JSON API.
Might be totally different people working on it too.
Well, I'm thinking, like, how often are you going to need to rewrite the API? Because with MVPs, you're often rewriting how it looks and how it feels, not necessarily how it works.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's new features or like things get added on, but in my experience, at least in the most of the time when things are being changed, is because like the look doesn't right, or the experience kind of is kind of sucky.
Yeah.
So you're massaging how it looks and how the user basically goes through the flow of the sale or whatever the outcome that you want them to take. But very rarely it's like, oh, our model needs to be completely changed, or it's like our domain is completely wrong. It's like, well, that's a huge failing, and like you have a lot more to change than just the API if that's the case. You know, if you have like, well, we didn't sell things and now we do, that's a big business model change. So these sweeping changes, that seems obvious, but I'm wondering how much will be in these cases. And I'll check back in a year and a half and see, like, hey, so the projects that I started that were split, are they still split? Like, how much is the same? What was the percentage of change in each? Because I'm guessing, this is me just trying to predict the future, but I'm guessing the front end is going to change significantly more than the back end would.
Yeah, I think I would totally agree with that. My experience has always shown me that the back end changes, but it evolves incrementally, whereas the front end tends towards, I guess you could say, it's more whimsical.
Yeah.
In that it might change based on design and UX and things like that. It might change based on new features that you need, but a lot of the time, even brand new features need just tweaks of the back end, whereas the front end,
yeah,
that could be totally different.
Well, I've been saying this for a couple of years now, is that no one ever judges me on my JavaScript. Mm-hmm. No clients ever judge me on my JavaScript.
Yeah.
They judge me on, like, you know, the size of a button or the font choice.
Yeah.
Or, like, that icon doesn't look right. You know, they care about different things, and so do users. Because, like, you know, you or I might visit a site and be like, wow, this site's, like, super slow, or, you know, I click this field and it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But, like, other people visit the sites. We're not seeing things that other people are seeing. Well, they're going to visit the site and be like, this looks ugly. Or, like, why is this button over here? It doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. I'm judging, like, the implementation versus, like, the aesthetic, which I think, you know, just, like, that's another challenge. Like, how do you solve for that? Or what level of responsibility do you have on that? If you're selling development, what level of responsibility have to be, like, influencing the experience?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's really tough to know.
And as soon as you have something that's touchy-feely, that's something that's very difficult to kind of quantify and to continue on a consistent basis. So when you're working on things that are on the front end and you're doing something in JavaScript, say, and you make this thing work a little bit faster or that thing search a little bit better, those are things where you're going to be probably the only person who notices that implementation, unless you have more people working on that.
Yeah.
But it's going to be this unconscious or subconscious thing with users and the client who are going to see that, and they're going to use it, and they're going to like it just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think splitting the back end and the front end in that way is going to probably pay dividends, in that you will be able to work on those things separately, and the front end will change more often.
You can almost pinpoint the area where you want to do the most iteration, I think.
Yeah.
You can kind of defer most work to a certain area by the way you architect the tool.
Yep.
Which also, I was thinking about, like, okay, well, if the industry keeps moving towards microservices, where is that legacy burden going to be a little bit less obvious?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if your whole system runs on, like, Lambda functions, well, it's like working on any individual function is sort of like, you know, oh, we're going to add this new feature, so we edit this function and manipulate this API or add this service. Or we're working on this little area, this little service. Maybe it's the authentication service, and now you can log in with Google. Now you can do social login or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a small piece that affects the larger tool, but how much of that is, you know, where does the legacy start if each piece is its own and it can be changed at any time independent of the other ones?
Yep. Yeah, I definitely agree. So, you know, do you have anything else that about development as a service that you would kind of put forth as an argument for why you would choose that over product work? I think we've covered quite a bit of stuff here. I'm sure we'll talk about it more in other episodes. In general, though, I just find that development as a service tends to keep you sharp as a developer, tends to keep you working on new and interesting things, and you get a lot back out of it. You get these concrete things that you've built and you can see and people use. At the very least, your client is going to use it.
I hope so, or you did something wrong.
Exactly. I find that, you know, in sort of an indirect way, it's good for building up a network of people that like you and think you do good work and trust you. There's a lot of benefits to it. And that's not to say there aren't benefits to product work or open source work and all these other things. But I do think that service work and development gets a bit of a it needs more cheerleaders, I guess.
Right.
We'll say that. It needs more cheerleaders because there's a lot of good to it. So I guess the next thing that we could talk about here is sort of now that we've decided that development as a service is a good thing, maybe something you, the listener, want to do, what are some good fundamentals for it? You know, what are sort of the core concepts that might help you start or succeed in service work and development? And so I'm going to start off with the first thing I start off with a lot of clients, which is requirement scoping. So you need to know what the problem is before you can solve it. You need to know what the outcomes you want to be, what those are. And so I don't know, I'm sure you have a lot of a lot to talk about on this, especially since you've been working on it, you know, some of these things lately.
Yeah, I think just as much as you want to know what you're supposed to do, you should also know what you're not supposed to do.
Sure.
I think that's just as important. I think even with design, and like I've dealt with a lot of like heavy design projects in the past, and it's more about like, if you can't tell me what you like, tell me what you hate.
Yeah.
Because that's an indicator. If you hate black, well, maybe you like white. If you hate blue, maybe you like red.
Mm-hmm.
If you hate green, maybe you like yellow. Like you can use these things to sort of help you along, especially with design. For development, it's a bit more of a gray area, to no pun intended, but for something like knowing the requirements, I even go as nitty gritty as like, do you own a domain?
Yeah.
How set up are you as a client for me as a service provider? Mm-hmm. So like, do you have like things that will just destroy your project are like, no one bought the domain, like their email doesn't work. Like the person who's supposed to help you launch is away. They didn't pick a host yet. Like all these different things can make it hard for you to be a good service provider, because you're just, those things are things that you either have to have a conversation about or that they're going to bring to the table. Either way, they're going to be a hiccup for you.
Yeah.
So just like you mentioned at the top of the show about being an expert is like, I think that this is one of those things where it's like, nailing your requirements and you're both in agreement, both parties, the client and vendor, is just going to be, everyone's happy. People get upset when things are missed, and people get angry when they have to do extra work they weren't necessarily agreeing to.
Yeah.
Just like getting a bill you weren't expecting as a client is like, that's never a fun conversation.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and you know what you were saying before about, oh, do you have a domain, for instance? There's a lot of things that you, as the provider here, need to do to determine where your client is at. You know, are they at my level, for instance, in technical savvy?
Mm-hmm.
Are they developers themselves? You know, how, what can I talk about that they're going to understand in the same way that I understand it? And if they don't, how can we talk so that we are both on the same level? There's a lot there to navigate. And I mean, that's why agencies have project managers and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's a large portion of their job is getting everyone on the same level.
It's critical to delivery.
Exactly. And so I think that's one of the biggest problems in service work is actually when people think they're on the same level, but they're not. And then you have something delivered that is not at all what was expected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when people have the biggest problems, that's when people don't want to pay their bills. And that's when,
right,
you know, you end up putting in more hours than was originally agreed on.
I think that happens from like both sides. I think those types of problems happen when you have a developer or a vendor that's just trying to make as much money as quickly as possible, but you also mm-hmm. have a client that's trying to save as much money as quickly as you know, as feasibly as possible or as reasonably mm-hmm. as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen problems where it's like I've had people come to me and be like, hey, we hired this person to do this, and like, it sucks. I'm like, how much did you pay for this? It's like, a couple $100. It's like, you can't be that surprised, you know.
Yeah.
add 2 zeros onto the bill.
Yeah,
because like, that's what you're looking at. As far as like some of these things that I've encountered in the past, and like, It's tough to sort of be able to communicate that, but sometimes, and like you said, the development as a service needs a sort of some cheerleaders, but it's kind of tough when you're sort of like, you have to undo some of the damage by people that don't really understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
They sell things that they couldn't deliver on, or they're made decisions that they couldn't, that were just wrong because they didn't understand their requirements. So it's a good example of not of delivering something that doesn't make sense and both people are upset.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think we could go on for a long time about requirement scoping and the whole dance with clients or project managers even.
Yeah.
There will almost certainly be more episodes on this. I can pretty much promise that.
I have a weekly story on.
Oh sure,
understanding requirements.
I think we could do a podcast that's all it was problems and successes in requirements and dealing with clients and
how
that
to
kind
scope
of thing. Exactly.
No scoping.
But yeah, definitely something that will help you out a lot is having a system for requirement scoping. A lot of this is experience and intuition. So some of it, unfortunately, you just have to
put the time in.
Mm-hmm. But definitely that would be the first thing on the list. You're not going to get very far if you don't work through some of that and learn how to be successful in scoping out requirements. So once you have your requirements, everything's on the level. Everyone agrees on what we want to do. A lot of the time, the next thing that you need to decide is what here is the most important. And so this might be part of the requirement scoping, or it might be something that you, the developer, need to decide because they're all equally important, but you need to decide what to work on first because that will affect how you build things later, that kind of thing. So, you know, do you have a system for this, James, or do you kind of wing it every time? What do you think about it?
It's tough. I used to have a sort of a survey, sort of like collection list that I would sort of go through. I wouldn't necessarily send it all the time to people unless I knew that they could fill it out, because it was, you know, it could be 30 questions. Things like, you know, do you own your domain? Do you have an email? Like, who's the main contact? Are you have hosting? Like, do you understand the difference between this and this? And it wasn't even always about like the answer. It was sometimes just about no answer, because no answer told me as much as an answer did.
Yeah.
So if someone says, it was a tight form. If you know about tight form, they allow you to like basically set up these questions in a really like sophisticated way. So I was able to like basically have a bunch of multiple choice questions on there saying like, do you have a domain? And then some of the answers might be yes, no, here it is, or like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept on a lot of the questions. I have a lot of answers that you were able to provide that said like, I don't know, or I don't know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could easily tell from like a submission that I got, if it was like filled with I don't knows and I don't know what that is, then I would know, okay, well, I need to, my scope just changed.
Yeah.
Because like people affect scope. Something that people, that project, that pricing doesn't necessarily reflect all the time is that people definitely influence the scope heavily. Who is working on this thing? That's part of the scope as much as like what is going to be provided.
Yeah.
How long it takes me to do something is radically different from someone that has 10 more years experience than me.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be a factor in the scope. Just like someone who's just started at the company yesterday is going to have a radically different scope than someone that's delivered at 500 projects for the same company.
Yep.
So even asking like, okay, well, who's involved in the project? Like who's actually paying the bill?
Yeah.
Was one that I would ask, like who's in charge of the finances for the project? Because if the person in charge of the finance and the person that's actually managing are not the same person, sometimes they don't agree. And when they don't agree, they get mad. So they get mad at each other and then they get mad at you.
Or at the very least, they can introduce delays while one person goes and says, I can't make that call. I'll have to get back to you.
Yeah.
That happens constantly. That's definitely something that I would agree should be scoped out. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's something you'll have in writing or anything like that, but you, the developer, you, the provider, need to know what you're dealing with, and because that can easily add time onto your project.
Yeah, I would say, and I would build the list. I had the list and I kept building it. So every time I encountered an issue, like, wow, this is really dumb or this is really painful, like, why didn't we do this? I would just add it to the list. Yeah. Be like, you know what? We keep having people come to us and they just don't own their domains. Or like, they think we're supposed to buy it for them. Or they think hosting is free. Or they think the maintenance is included for like 2 years. It's like, where are you getting this information? Which means their assumptions, I need to either eliminate them or confirm them.
Yeah.
So that was what my list was for. So I'd say to like boil it down to, you know, a tagline would be know what you need to continue.
Yeah.
Like know what you need to actually move forward.
Yeah. I guess if you're someone who has more of an engineering background, you might be thinking in terms of Gantt charts. I hope I have that right. I don't have an engineering background. I have a computer science background.
Well, you might have Gantt charts for like your timeline of delivery because they're those, they're the blocks that like...
Sure.
Move but horizontally.
Gantt charts are the charts that they determine where the stoppages are, correct?
Yeah.
So you can't continue until this is done. Yeah. See, I did take it. Something away from school.
Yeah. You learned something at school.
We learned something there. And so that's definitely, I mean, coming back to prioritization and you know, task planning and things like that, I think that's definitely something that as a developer you need to think about first. You know, I can't build this part of the system until we have users,
right?
You know, or maybe you can, and that would be a better way to do it. It always depends. Maybe you're doing TDD, test-driven development, so you're going to start with writing tests, but if you have a week to build something, TDD might not be in the pipeline for this project.
Totally.
For instance.
Did you have a list of like little tricks or any sort of like common things that you're trying to pull out of every like initial engagement?
I don't. I am not as much of a list person, I think, as right. as maybe you are. I do like making lists, but I've never done that particular one. When I get a new project, though, I spend quite a bit of time writing out in a bunch of different ways how I'm going to prioritize and what's going to take place when. Mm-hmm. And I always do that after the requirements scoping. And that's almost entirely for me. A lot of the time, the client doesn't see any of that.
Right.
That's just so that when I wake up in the morning, I know this is the next thing I need to do. Mm-hmm. And it really does help you keep that sort of 30,000 foot view of, you know, this is what we're doing. This is what's important. But I would say, definitely you want to look at the things that you can't do until something is done. That's those
blockers.
Are the things those are blockers. You can't go without those. Then after that, I would prioritize anything, honestly, what I've been doing lately is anything that I don't particularly want to work on, I do first.
Oh, really?
Which is the opposite of how I used to do things. But the last thing I want to do now is get to that last 10% of the project, and it's just filled with all the tedious, uninteresting things that I've been putting off because I built all the cool, interesting things already. So that's more for me, you know. Another developer might do that completely differently, but a lot of the time I'll build like the really tedious, boring things first when I have the most motivation, interest, energy in the project, rather than, you know, when you're coming up against deadlines and you've potentially burnt out a little bit on it.
That's a really interesting approach.
Yeah,
I like that. That sounds really cool. Yeah, I can definitely see the enticing things that you want to do and then leaving the worst things, or, you know, in the person's eyes, the worst things last is like, ugh. The last thing you want to do is run one more mile when you've ran 10 straight.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, I don't want to do this.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons why I really like TDD is like, nobody wants to write tests after you've built everything. Like, that's the last thing everybody wants to do.
In production, man.
You know, it's like, well, you know, we already did all the cool, fun things. Like, it works when I use it. It must work.
Yeah,
like,
it works on my computer.
Whereas, if you're testing as you build things, I find I get a lot of enjoyment out of that. You know, I can test it, run the test. Oh, it works. You know, right. And then later when I'm building things, I can keep running the tests and know that everything is still working. Nothing has broken, that kind of thing.
Do you think the satisfaction is more about having something you know works well, or knowing that something is sort of done properly?
So, honestly, I don't care that much for whether something is done properly, because that could mean a million things.
Right.
I care that something works well, and I care that it will be reliable, I guess, so that I'm not losing any sleep over this thing potentially crashing or something in the middle of the night, right, or when I'm on vacation.
Well, there was that Microsoft study of TDD where they said they basically pit two teams against each other, same requirements. Mm-hmm. One used TDD, one didn't. Mm-hmm. The one who used TDD took 30% longer, but they had 90% less bugs.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that there are arguments against TDD as well that I will also concede these days. And believe me, I'm definitely a proponent of TDD. I like it a lot.
Like you said earlier, the big asterisk is it took 30% longer.
It took
30% longer.
Well, and I think that that's something that could fluctuate quite a bit depending on what kind of project. So if you're working on something where the requirements are very concrete and unlikely to change, then TDD is an awesome thing to do.
Totally. Yeah.
If you're working on something where, like, you're not even really sure what you want, you're just sort of trying things out, TDD is really hard to do because you've now doubled the number of things that you need to redo when you change it later.
Sure.
So that's definitely, you know, like for a lot of MVPs, if you're doing something really new, like TDD is not necessarily something I would recommend to a lot of people. Even though I really like TDD, because you're gonna get halfway through that MVP and realize, oh, you know what, it would work way better if users worked this way instead.
Sure.
And now you don't have to just rewrite users, you have to rewrite all of the tests.
Yeah.
So
that's happened to me.
Yeah.
It's happened to me a couple times where I'm careful with the tests. I don't necessarily follow like tests first, I guess implementation second. I kind of do a little bit of both. I kind of play in both worlds. When I know the requirements, I do the test and then make a fail pass.
Yeah.
But most of the time I like playing with the thing first and experimenting. And then finally when I'm done, I'm like, okay, I'm going to write all the tests that say this is what it should do and this is what it should not do.
Yeah.
And sort of, that's how I've been doing it. I found that I write way more assertions than maybe some other people do, but I find that, I typically don't have to go back and change, like make sweeping changes on things. Cause I've opted for flexibility, over maybe speed.
Yeah. I think one of the other arguments for that is that a lot of TDD people are thinking like lower level or smaller unit tests, things like that. I've heard some pretty compelling arguments talking about, I guess you would call them integration tests. I tend to think of them more overall as like outcome tests.
Right.
You know, like this is what we want to happen, so this is what we're testing for, rather than testing, you know, did this thing save? Did this thing do that? We want to know, you know, is there a new user in the database and is their name this? And are we happy with all of those things, rather than, you know,
This method was called,
that kind of thing. Because at a certain point, you know, you're testing the framework or you're testing whatever, the language or something. Yeah.
Sure.
And so it's not that those aren't worth doing. But definitely if you're working on something that's new and might change, I think the outcome testing or integration, whatever you want to call it, is a better way to go about, because it's going to mean less rewriting. And in my opinion, you're still getting a lot of value out of it, because if one of those smaller things that you might catch in a unit test fails, that outcome's still going to fail. Like you're still going to have a failing test. You might have a little less information than you would have with that unit test. Mm-hmm. And that's when I would go in and start writing those.
Right. This has been Testing Minute with Carter.
Yeah.
Testing Tangent.
I'm sure we'll have to do some episodes on testing.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So once you've prioritized everything, you know, a lot of this then moves on into just general development skills and things like that. And so we talked a bit about having a T-shaped skill set before. So
right. width over breadth or breadth over width.
Yeah, and I think that there's definitely an argument that a lot of people would make about being a specialized service developer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you are the, I don't know, you are the AWS Lambda person.
Guru.
Like you are the guru. You know everything about it and you're the best at it. So everyone hires you for that and you don't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a lot of benefits to that. I think that that's a difficult thing to become. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time. And at the start, at the very least, you're probably going to benefit more from being a little bit more general.
Sure.
You're going to want to be able to integrate your things with other things. If you're a service developer, the odds are better that you're not going to have some of these other specialized people doing these other things for you, so you might have to deploy your own work.
Mm-hmm.
You might have to write that front end, even though you mostly do back end work. You know, those kind of things. And so if you can do some of those other things, it's going to help you a lot. And then as you continue in your career, I think specializing more and more, there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think just as a matter of course, most people do at some point to some degree. Now that doesn't mean that that's all they do for the rest of their life, but they might be known a little bit more for being the WebRTC person or, which is a video chat thing.
Sure.
Or
TDD person.
The TDD person,
yeah.
Exactly. So there's something to be said for both, but I think that, both in their own time.
I think my advice would be treat your life like or treat your specialization like eras of your life.
Sure.
So have the era where you were specialized in, PHP. Have the era of your career where you're specialized in Node. Have the era of your career where you're specialized in like program that language that hasn't come out yet, Crystal mm-hmm. Lang or something,
yeah.
Something right on the edge. And I think that's a different way to look at it. But I feel like you kind of get the best of both. Whereas like be an expert in the thing you're in now, but look at the next thing too.
Yeah.
Be looking at the next thing, because then you can sort of hop between being an expert and being a generalist.
Yeah.
So let your expertise in one skill fall away while growing it in another one. So move along that T. So if you picture that T, move to the right or move to the left and let your depth grow and move along with you.
Yeah.
So then you can also, you can be a specialist, but you can also be a generalist. Hopefully you're not going to forget anything that you're an expert or you were expert in, 10 years ago, or at least in our case, like 5 years ago in terms mm-hmm. of web stuff. But I think that you can probably treat your life more like a moving target more than like being more and more narrow.
Yeah.
Just pointed in a different direction every once in a while.
Exactly. And things do fade away naturally anyways. If you were the jQuery person,
mm-hmm.
5-10 years ago, I don't know actually how old jQuery is, but a while back.
Is 10 years old.
Maybe.
I think it is. Yeah.
I don't know. A lot of these things I still think of as like new, but they're not at all. But
I think, I think jQuery, you're safe to say, is 10 years old.
Yeah, it's pretty old.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with being an expert at that. It's a very good and useful tool.
Totally.
But as time goes on, the demand for that is probably going down. And so keeping your eye on other things is going to help out a lot. And I think that's the risk of being a specialist, is that you do take or have more of a risk of that specialty becoming obsolete just mm-hmm. naturally through no fault of your own. And having at least a bit of that T shape there instead of just being that complete specialist will help you find the next thing too. So it's really mm-hmm. hard to go from only knowing one thing to knowing something completely new, but if you know a lot about one or two or three things and a little bit about 10 things, it's a lot easier to go and know a lot about the next thing that you're going to specialize a little more in.
Yeah. I think about these developers or these programmers that work for these banks where they have mm-hmm. these legacy systems, where it's like these consultants and programmers are like they're millionaires because it's cheaper to pay these programmers to maintain a system than it would be to overhaul the entire system.
Totally.
So this is the technical debt you know, discussion that is way beyond the scope of this particular conversation, but
yeah,
those people are so specialized that they're the only people that can do it, and because they're the only people that can do it, they demand, they've become millionaires.
Yep.
They've become millionaires because they were holdouts. They were staying and sticking to this thing, and as the other people moved on and became experts in something else, their depth just stagnated. But that stagnation meant that they were the lone survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's like, hey, you want to hire someone to do this thing? It's like, you have a list of 10 people.
Yeah.
Like, they're shockingly small.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So, you know,
Fortran developer who knows this specific bank system, like, yeah, there, how many people are there in the world that know that thing?
Yeah. And like, it's crazy. So, it can be a blessing and a curse, is that you're only ever going to work on that thing forever, mm-hmm. but you know, you're going to be comfortable, at least financially, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But,
and again, there is the risk that those things do move on to something else at some point.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So it's one of those things, like, it great risk, great reward. Mm-hmm.
It's any investment is the same.
Yeah. You're always going to be sacrificing something one way or the other, no matter what you do. You have to decide which things are more important to you. But maybe that's a topic we could go into more in depth on a different episode here.
Totally.
So after your T-shaped skill set here, I think one of the hardest things as a developer, and one of the most necessary things especially when you're doing service work, mm-hmm. is being the pragmatic and practical code police, or the code executioner, where you have to cut out certain things, kill off certain ideas, shiny objects, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And a lot of that will come down to timeline requirements, budgets, things like that. And so if you're a developer who gets good at that, I think that you are going to be the joy of your project manager's life in some ways, because it is so often the opposite. It's usually the developer trying to expand the scope on those particular things, where they really want this, they want to do things this way, they want to use this new shiny technology, that kind of thing, whereas clients are kind of the opposite. They're looking to expand the features, you know, those kind of things, whereas you're trying to implement things differently.
Yeah. We both have different sort of, although you're aligned on, you know, what needs to occur, like, mm-hmm. how the road to get there is very different depending on who you ask. You can ask everyone if they're aligned on the outcome, but usually it's like how we get there is where everyone argues. It's like, well, we need to start here. Well, we need to start here. Well, if we don't start here, we're just going to start here. This is what the middle should look like. And everyone's arguing about where the middle actually is.
Yeah.
So I think it is good to have a, I think it's like, don't be so precious about the work too. I think that helps. I've told people that I work with, like, don't get all bent out of shape because someone wants to change something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not yours. This isn't your personal project that they're telling you to delete stuff out of. This is their project. They want to delete something out of it.
Yeah.
If that's the case, then let them do that. It makes it a lot easier to sort of accept when you take away some of the, like, the preciousness of it. That you don't really have to be married to it. It doesn't, you know, I think of it as, like, even no matter what work I'm doing, unless it's my own personal thing, I always think about, well, you know, this is for someone else. I always think about, I'm doing it for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing them a favor either. They're paying me to do this. So I'm just going to do it, and if they want me to change it, cool. I'll help them to make a decision based on my experience and my knowledge. But at the end of the day, it's like, it's they're asking for you to do something for them.
Yep.
Don't lead them down the wrong road, but also don't stop them from actually getting there by just being difficult, by just saying no all the time, or just trying to squeeze in the cool thing because, you know, you feel like it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I've definitely been in situations where, for instance, you know, someone is really trying to do something what they consider the proper way. And that's why before I said, I don't care that much for proper, because a lot of the time it has nothing to do with the goals that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe they're trying to do something where the database is really normalized. You know, everything's spread out over a lot of pivot tables and things like that. Mm-hmm. But this is a short sort of quick and dirty MVP project, and this is taking us way more time. Queries are way more complicated, those kind of things. You know, so instead of having things so spread out that way, we're just going to switch this over, and we're going to have a field that just has that result that we're going to look for right in it. So we can just get it right away, no problem, super easy. I've had people get really upset about that because, well, that's not proper. That's not, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what you have to think about is, what is the, what's the purpose of this project? Is this going to be a problem in the future?
Yeah.
Because if it is, then absolutely do it the way, you know, do it this really normalized way. Do it properly, in air quotes.
Right.
But if it's not, like, if that's never going to be an issue, if that's never going to come up, then do it the way that's going to get the outcome that everybody is looking for without blowing up the budget, without putting everyone over on timelines, without making life more miserable, honestly.
Or introducing bugs or
whatever. Introducing bugs. Yeah, as soon as you're introducing complexity or just anything new, extra features, whatever, a lot of the time you're introducing risk of bugs and risk of problems. And I think that if you can cut out things, every time you delete something, you're simplifying things and you're reducing your risk, basically.
I've been using the phrase, is it nice or necessary?
Yeah, that's
a great phrase. If it's nice, you can delete it and everything's still great. If it's necessary, you delete it and everything breaks.
Yeah.
So I've been advocating lately for the type of work that I'm doing, which is like, start with the necessary and add the nice things. It's the same concept of progressive enhancement when you're talking about design or talking about front end development, which is like, we can start with the shapes, and we're starting with the lowest common denominator. We're starting with our worst case scenario and building from there.
Yeah.
I've been saying this too a lot. No one cares about perfect. When things are perfect, no one notices. People notice when things go wrong. People notice when things are bad.
Yeah.
They say nothing when things are perfect. Mm-hmm. So why even care about the perfect case? Because no one, you're never going to know, because no one's ever going to say anything, because it's perfect.
Yeah.
So plan for those problems. It makes you a pessimist, you know, but the idea is that you can be optimistic that the pessimistic case has been handled.
Yep.
So I've been using those kind of terms with my team, is like talking about like, okay, well, you know, can we plan for bad stuff? Let's see what this, show me a design where everything is just terrible, like short title with a super long title. Tiny little blog post body with a huge blog post body. There's only one image in all of the blog posts, and there's 12 on the page.
Yeah,
I want to see those designs, because those are the cases where everyone is arguing about what it should look like.
Yeah.
No one's arguing about the contrived scenario where everything's perfect and everything looks fantastic. All the titles are the exact same, and they have line breaks in the same spot. Like, no one argues with that it looks fantastic.
Yeah.
They argue when it's like, hey, we have missing images. What are we going to do about that? Hey, our titles are super long. What are we going to do about that? Hey, we don't have a description for this thing. What are we going to do about that? So you think about all the other cases, everything but perfect, because perfect you don't have to think about.
Yeah, that reminds me of, I'm sure, so many developers' first experiences working with a designer where they get this design. It looks amazing. It looks perfect. And then it gets implemented. And it turns out, well, the client actually doesn't have that many pictures for this. And, well, it turns out that sometimes this text is quite a bit longer than the original design showed up. And so things look goofy.
Or, the blue is a little bit, it's a different shade of blue.
Mm-hmm.
So everything just looks a little bit weird.
Yeah. We didn't really consider what this would look like on, we thought about the phone. We're good designers. We thought about responsive. We didn't think about what it looks like on an iPad Pro, though. Is that a computer? Or what size of screen is that?
Yeah. And it turns out, like, all of our clients use iPad Pros.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it needs to look good on an iPad Pro.
Well, they show it off in their conference room, which has a computer hooked up to the TV. It's running Windows XP, and it doesn't have ClearType or anti-aliasing for fonts, so it looks a little weird with your custom font there. Now it's that's definitely something you might run into if you're working with a variety of designers and things. So I think, you know, this disciplined pragmatism is an incredibly useful trait, and I think it's something that most people have to build up over time. I've met almost no people who have that sort of, you know, seem to have that as an innate characteristic of their personality.
No, it's most
people
have
to learn to kill their darlings a little bit.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's tough too. It's tough because like you feel like you invested so much time in something and then you just go ahead and delete it. Just like select that file and just hit delete.
Yeah. Or even you've spent so much time learning about this is the way you do things or this is the best way, or I just spent 2 weeks going through a course where we do these things, and so you're trying to apply these things when they may not, it may not be the best scenario.
Right.
And so then you're also killing your darling there in that you've invested yourself into that idea.
Right.
And now you can't do it. So you do have to have that pragmatism, or else, you're going to run over your budgets. You're going to run over your timelines. You're going to frustrate the people you're working with. It's definitely, I would say, one of my number one traits that I like to see in someone when I have to work with them is, can they get this done and be practical about it?
I think that's definitely the case with people that we idolize in the development community. It's like, how many people that you idolize are rigid and immutable when it comes to their opinion? Or when it comes to best practices, or when it comes to, like, you know, choose doing it the right way, TM.
Right.
The people that I idolize are the people that are like, hey, we can fix this scenario using this trick, or like using this clever way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
They don't reach for best practices to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
They reach for expertise, experience. They reach for other tool sets. It's not always like, it's not literal tools, like mental tools. How can we think about this problem in a different way? What if we turn this problem upside down and do it in reverse? Can we actually solve it? Can we still maintain some semblance of what you might call, you know, best practice, but also, you know, deliver on the thing we need to deliver on?
Yeah.
If best practices are keeping you from delivering, like, you're never going to finish.
Yep.
Everything could always be better or more, I guess, more hardened. I don't know, more of a textbook example, I guess.
Everything can
more
be optimized, improved.
And,
everything can be better.
Right.
But,
what's the LinkedIn founder? He says that if you're not embarrassed by your first release, then you release too late.
Yeah, I always like quoting that when I can, particularly to clients who are, maybe this is their first project or something like this. You know, they're spinning up a business related to this or something like that.
Right.
Because a lot of people, their only exposure to these things is movies and TVs and school and things like that, where you are always dealing with that. If it was physics, it's the frictionless environment, you know, where nothing goes wrong. Everything has a million years and unlimited budget and all of these things.
Or in the movie, they come up against some crazy deadline and something, they all of a sudden get more money.
Yeah.
Or all of a sudden the deadline's changed, or they find some amazing person who fixes it.
Exactly. And so the idea of being embarrassed as a good thing, is something I like, because you're embarrassed because you're comparing it with your ideal perfect scenario. The people who are using it are comparing it with not having that thing, or using the old things that are worse.
Well, that's the sort of thing that people say when they talk about like not supporting older browsers, which is like, these people that are using these browsers are used to the web looking a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to take the experience of today and basically just gut it, or, you know, ruin it, or invest in it to make it look like it was supposed to look 7 years ago isn't a useful investment.
No.
You're actually slicing your own Achilles just to like appease some sort of dwindling population. It's not really, it doesn't really make, you know, good investment sense as far as from like what you want to spend your time on. Spend your time on planning for the next thing, not wondering what yesterday was like. Thinking about like, okay, well, we have this thing now, we have this stuff now, like we can improve it later, we can make it better, instead of hindering it and trying to be like, okay, well, we can't have it out there. I had a client once that was, they were holding back on the launch of their site because like they were concerned about some spacing issues on like a couple of the pages. When I talked to them, they had an event coming up and this site was the only way to advertise about it. So I said, we can hold back. What does that do to the timeline of your event? And they were like, well, yeah, we have this, like, I'm like, this is your opening, right? Like, you need this thing to be up. Would you be willing to live with less ticket sales or us fixing the spacing as soon as possible? And it's like, that's really, put that way, it's very hard to disagree with that. Yeah. It's like the spacing issues, they're not going to stop me from selling tickets. Not having the site live, that'll definitely, absolutely stop me from selling tickets.
Yeah.
It's about that balance, right?
I agree. And I think as the developer, a lot of the time, you need to be the person who's advocating for these things, because you are the person who is closest and most affected by that immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, a project manager, they're closer to the client, and so they might be swayed towards fixing the spaces, for instance. Whereas the most pragmatic person, in my opinion, often should be the developer. I've definitely ran into cases where a client, you know, they have an old version of their application or an old version of their site up, mm-hmm. and they're waiting to launch version 2.0 or whatever, until, you know, like some minor tiny details that mm-hmm. only they will really notice. And they're going, well, we don't want to launch something up that's worse.
Right.
And saying, what you need to think about is this worse than is what is out there right now?
Mm-hmm.
Almost certainly not. It is almost hopefully certainly way not. Better. Yeah. And if it's something new, then it's literally infinitely better because there is no comparison. It didn't exist before. So it's always better to be pragmatic and get those things out there. Yeah, definitely. So being pragmatic, I think we can move on from that one here. So I only have one more thing on my list here. If there's anything you want to talk about, we can definitely do that. So I wanted to talk a little bit about planned experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
So basically trying new things or risking becoming obsolete. And so that could be an entire agency. That could be a single developer.
Right.
Basically, you need to find the things that are going to take you to, I hate this phrasing, but take you to the next level or...
Yeah. Is that on your t-shirt?
Yeah, it should be.
That's your marketing slug line, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you need to have something that is going to keep you competitive, is going to help you... succeed more and more. If you're not improving, you're stagnating, basically.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that you have to be using every new shiny object there is out there, but you should always be looking for those things, and you should be planning experimentation in with them. You can't rely on things just sort of serendipitously working out and oh well, we managed to use all this new stuff and it just happened. You have to pick those things, and you need to place them. And you don't want to compromise a client project or anything like that.
What's that saying about luck? Luck is opportunity meets preparation or whatever.
Exactly.
If you're not prepared to take on something like, for when I was starting my first business, I had starting with projects with a couple $1,000s. Then it was now they have almost $10,000. Okay, well, now they have over $10,000. Okay, now they have $20,000. Now they have $30,000. Now they're coming back to you again with another $10,000 to spend. So, that type of... If I'm delivering the same caliber of work in the same way from the $2,000 project to the $25,000 project, then there's something... Either I'm a genius marketer and I'm being able to sell the same thing, mm-hmm. you know, for 10 times
more. Or you're getting ripped
more.
Off before.
Right, or yeah, I was underselling my skill or undervaluing my skill. But hopefully that the graph that shows the increase in price, we also see an increase in value. We also see an increase in skill or an increase in delivery or an increase in satisfaction.
Yep.
Or some sort of parallel measure. Mm-hmm. And so that means that maybe the thing is experimentation around not just how what you are using, the tools you are using, the packages you're installing, mm-hmm. but it could be, hey, I'm using a Mac instead of a Windows. I'm using a Windows instead of a Mac. Mm-hmm. I'm using this programming, I'm using this IDE now. It could be just those changes in tools to see what you can, you know, to use your marketing phrase, take yourself to the next level. pick something up and try it. And if it doesn't work, throw it away. But let those things that are really going to help you move along. I remember sticking with, I remember when Grunt first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And like I started using them, like, oh, this is cool. And then Gulp came out, and I was like, oh, I don't want to switch. I just learned this grunt thing, and so I used that for a little while. Then finally, I was like, you know what? I think I'm okay to switch now. I see the benefits, so eventually I switched to Gulp. Mm-hmm. And now we have Webpack coming out, and it's like, oh, I don't want to change over again. I just changed like 2 years ago. Now I got to change every 2 years. I got to change my build tools, but I'm seeing welcome all these cool
JavaScript.
Things. Yeah, welcome to JavaScript, man. Well, JavaScript, not even on the front end. JavaScript and you're on your command line.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, now I can definitely reach for that next tool because it lets me do different things in a different way. It's more optimized. Mm-hmm. It's faster. I can change my workflow a little bit to make it more appropriate, more optimized. I was thinking about, I was working on a project today where there's no, like, live reloading. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not used to that because I mentioned earlier my sort of template project, I have live reloads built in.
Yeah.
So like you change a template or you change a CSS file or you compile your JavaScript and it automatically refreshes the browser.
Yep.
So like I go to my editor, I make my changes, I hit save, I go to the browser, it's already there. But like this one, I'm like saving, go refresh, scroll down, whatever. Like mm-hmm. it's just like, oh, this experience is clunky. Like
yeah.
this is how I used to do it. This is silly. Why was I doing this? Now it's like, hey, learn these tools, learn these things, put them in there. Take the time, even if it's, I even take the time when it's unpaid. It's mm-hmm. like, hey, I'm just going to like, if I could just spend 30 minutes here, I'll be a lot happier when I am getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
So great.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think that's a topic we might need to cover at some point, which is how do you continue learning and keep up and what is reasonable, what is unreasonable? You know, do you take time to learn these things in your off time?
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody can do that kind of thing.
Right.
We'll brush over it today because that would take quite a bit of time. But definitely, I think in some way, whether it's, I would argue that any business that's doing software development is going to benefit majorly from planning in some experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
You could do that in all kinds of ways, but there needs to be an intentional decision to move forward with the things that you can do, trying to improve things. Otherwise, you will eventually stagnate.
Yeah, and, I don't think anyone needs any like convincing necessarily. Yeah. Like you can look at the world and be like, well, that company's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like Blockbuster.
Yeah.
Perfect example of like the writing was on the wall and no one did anything about it.
Yeah. Well, and I think almost everyone is going to agree that like you need to improve all these things. Mm-hmm. I think what people don't necessarily think about though is planning that out, like putting that into your like schedule that
right.
should be something
right.
that
that's
you schedule
point.
In
for
that
sure.
should be built into scopes and requirements and things like that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean compromising a client project, but it means looking for the times when you can benefit the client and do this
yeah.
experimentation.
Have a mini existential crisis in every project.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. How am I going to make this useful? How am I going to capitalize on this one project in the future?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess I don't have this on my list, but I guess the final thing is always keep the outcome and your client in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing service, you have a client, it might be your boss.
Totally.
But you always have a client, and so they are what matters here, and the outcome for them is what matters, not your sense of what is proper coding, not your sense of a lot of other things. It doesn't mean that you don't get to do things your way and do things that are interesting, all those things, but at the end of the day, that's probably the final thing I'd say is keep that in mind, that it's not about you, you are doing service work.
Definitely, yeah. Absolutely.
So yeah, I think that's probably a good place to wrap up unless you have anything else you'd like to go over.
No, I think we nailed everything from TDD to progressive enhancement. Oh, and also, you know, development as a service.
Yeah.
Right.
The name of this podcast, what you're interested in, and everything between. So yeah, I think we'll sign off for now, and thanks for listening.